Welcome back to Theia. I'm Joe Consorti. Today I'm here with the man behind it all, one of the men behind it all, Smeet Bhatt, the co-founder of Theia and a Bitcoin accelerationist. Smeet, welcome to your own show, which sounds very strange to say, but welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Joe. Glad we could find some time to talk about a bunch of things which are both Theia and general Bitcoin stuff. Yeah.
Absolutely. Long time coming. You know, we've had great discussions about this in the past, and so I'm excited for our viewers to learn more about it. First things first, I guess, talk to us about a little bit about your background and kind of your history out in San Francisco and Silicon Valley.
Yeah. So I think like my sort of professional background, I think of it as like two broad parts. The first part was relatively short. Started my career at Deutsche Bank on Wall Street, you know, in the FX and rates trading division. So my first foray into like, you know, global macro and general financial markets and global economics started out at Deutsche Bank. This was way back, like in 2012, 2013, 2014 timeframe. So we're talking about more than a decade ago. But yeah, that was my real sort of, you know, exposure to financial markets and everything that kind of like eventually led me to Bitcoin. Thankfully, I didn't stick around with, you know, Wall Street too long, and firmly made a jump into the startup ecosystem, you know, the tech industry sometime around 2015. So moved to San Francisco in 2015, started my first company that was in the virtual reality domain. This was way back before virtual reality or any of this thing was kind of like cool. Yeah, I was, you know, building my first company. We had a pretty decent sort of, you know, journey out there. It was still early days. You know, the virtual reality industry in itself did not really sort of hit a core product market fit. But we were trying to like do a bunch of different things and we succeeded to a certain degree. After which I felt that, hey, like this is still a few years away. The form factor does not really sort of make sense. So kind of like moved on from that startup, and then joined the venture capital industry. So I was with a very large sort of global fund called IDG Ventures, you know, sort of managed more than $1 billion in AUM. And the idea was to invest in early stage startups, you know, everything from consumer tech to fintech to enterprise software. I was mostly focused on the enterprise software and the fintech side of things. And yeah, I got to work with a lot of like, you know, phenomenal founders, got to, you know, understand various different domains that were kind of like outside my realm. And that led me to sort of further go down this sort of the startup ecosystem. So yeah, last 10 years, I've basically started two companies of my own. And then I've also been an investor. I've been a founding member at other enterprise software companies. So, yeah, it's been a mix of early stage leadership experience, execution, strategy, you know, business development, marketing, and then all of this was happening while in the background I was still very very much you know, into like economics and global macro and running my own sort of, you know, family office portfolio and things like that. And that kind of gradually led me to Bitcoin. And it hit a point in 2022 when I'm like, hey, I need to spend my full-time career in Bitcoin. And that's when we launched Theia.
Phenomenal. So I want to ask a little bit more about getting into Bitcoin because everyone has a different story. I know for me, similar to you, I'm doing a lot of the, you know, early stage stuff. I'm working with you. I'm working over with Nick Bhatia. I'm doing a lot of business development, growth marketing, things like that. But I did study finance, and that's where I found Bitcoin. Where did you, along the way, end up first hearing about Bitcoin, and kind of what drove you to want to learn more about it?
Yeah. So again, I think I think of my Bitcoin journey in sort of three distinct phases. The first phase when I was almost sort of completely skeptical and to the extent where I did not want to like, you know, spend more time studying it. This was back in like 2013, I think on the trading floor at Deutsche Bank. So I used to work with, you know, FX traders, and naturally, like, you know, people were excited about this, you know, trying to make like fiat dollars on this new asset class that was emerging as Bitcoin. So that was my first sort of kind of like, you know, first time I heard about Bitcoin in 2013. But you know, as banking industry, you know, still does not necessarily fully understand Bitcoin. 2013 was a completely different realm. Most of the knowledge around me or most of the people around me were not really sort of thinking about the big picture, and that kind of led me to like ignore it till about 2016, 2017. Then came the second phase where I think a lot of my sort of knowledge base or epistemic sort of knowledge that led me eventually core interest of Bitcoin started happening. So my journey has been a little different in the sense that I was not fortunate kind of to like, let's say, learn about Bitcoin from the core sort of Bitcoin educators that you and I know today. But my Bitcoin journey kind of began with, I would say there are three or four people who I think as influential folks in terms of my own thinking, and that naturally led me to like explore Bitcoin on my own. So, folks like Ray Dalio, believe it or not, but even like Taleb, and then more sort of recently, I would say like Peter Thiel and Balaji. So I think these four people have been like very, very influential in terms of like how on my own I got into Bitcoin. Obviously, like Ray Dalio or Taleb did not necessarily talk about Bitcoin when I was studying those folks and reading their literature. Peter Thiel and Balaji were obviously sort of more pro Bitcoin from the get-go. So that kind of like piqued my interest. This is around 2018, 2019. So I'm reading the big debt crisis that just came out in 2017, I believe, by Ray Dalio, and I'm like thinking, okay, like the economic history is full of like this interesting phenomenon where like central banks are eventually like pushed towards massive amounts of monetary printing to monetize their own debt, and that eventually leads to like either like some kind of inflation and in extreme cases a currency collapse. Again, none of this was specifically to Bitcoin, but I was just sort of thinking about like economics and history from a grand
It's
picture
also
point of
one of the
view.
books
And
that I read initially to bring me into Bitcoin as well, Principles for Navigating Big Debt Crises.
absolutely, I think it's one of the most underrated book in the global macro scene, I would say. There are some people who have sort of I think referenced it, but I feel Dalio also wrote a second book called The Changing World Order, which is also again quite an influential book. But I think his first part, The Big Debt Crisis, was definitely more theoretical, sort of more sort of rigorous about its analysis of history and things like that. And then yeah, and the final phase kind of happened during COVID. So March 2020, things are going wild, financial markets crash, gold shoots up. And the central banks, as they always do, they embark upon a journey to like just print lots and lots of dollars. And in the next couple of months, obviously, stock markets start roaring again. And I'm like, what is happening? Like the world is shut down by their own policies, and then now they're printing money to like pump the stocks and pump other asset classes. So yeah, that 2020 is when I basically sort of fully got into Bitcoin. I think like COVID crisis was very, very sort of critical in terms of my own sort of spiritual journey into Bitcoin, and since 2020, I think that there has not been like any looking back. I also personally feel that, I mean, there are several OG Bitcoiners who have had different points in time over the last 10 years when they got fully convinced about Bitcoin. For me, that was COVID. Bunch of different reasons, obviously, both on the fiscal and the monetary side, but also just global governments curbing people's freedom and things like that. So yeah, that was a final turning point, and since 2020 there has not really been any going back. And as I said, in 2022 it hit a point where I'm like, okay, I need to spend now full time into Bitcoin, and that was the birth of Theia.
Wonderful. This is a common theme I'm finding, actually. I've found with almost everyone. I mean, people come into Bitcoin because there's a catalyst in the world around them that kind of drives the utility home for Bitcoin, like the value proposition. How do I want to position myself amidst all of this chaos? In the United States, we have it really good with the US dollar's position as the global hegemon for world FX. But, by the same token, you see how bad it can get in crises like COVID, and it really accelerates. It either ignites our understanding and want to learn more about things that can allow us to hedge ourselves, or it accelerates kind of that pre-existing skepticism. For me, I know the situation was relatively similar. So, what drove you to want to start Theia, like the story behind it? Obviously, this is how you entered Bitcoin, but you could have done any number of things when it comes to building building software, contributing to, you know, maybe Bitcoin Core, building a mining company. Obviously, you work in tech. You've historically worked in tech. So why self-custody specifically? Like, why did you see this as the way that you can contribute to Bitcoin's adoption?
Yeah, well, I mean, like, self-custody has always been like a very, very important sort of critical topic in terms of Bitcoin's adoption over the years. And we've seen a variety of generation of different wallets, like, you know, paper wallets were a thing in 2011, 2014, and then came like an age of like sort of single-sig hardware wallets, and then, you know, multi-sigs started sort of kind of becoming popular, but only in like super niche circles. So on my own, but so by the way, again, so just for a second, going back to like Deutsche Bank, I used to work in the FX and rates division, which used to like sort of manage counterparty risk. So counterparty risk is something that was very, very deeply like, you know, important. And it's a concept that I always kind of, you know, intuitively understood relatively better compared to most of the people who work in tech or like non-finance domains and things like that. So for me, like leaving a bear asset like Bitcoin on exchanges was never really an option. Like, as soon as I got into Bitcoin, I was kind of like super convinced about going the self-custodial route. Now, when going self-custodial, obviously you run into a bunch of different challenges in terms of like, what's the best hardware wallet? How do you make backups? What happens if I'm not around? And then that's how I got into like multisig. And what I realized was that there are obviously a couple of companies out there who are sort of supporting people in terms of like doing multisig, but still the user experience was quite broken. The whole education, the whole journey about taking, you know, making people understand about the importance of self-custody and why like multisig is the gold standard of self-custody was a real missing piece, and specifically a missing piece in the ecosystem that I belong to, which is like sort of Silicon Valley tech startups in general. So again, the OG Bitcoiners were kind of like doing multisig for a while, but by any stretch of imagination, multisig and self-custody are not really the most sort of dominant ways in which how people outside of that niche circle sort of, you know, take care of their Bitcoin. So I thought it's a very, very important missing piece in terms of driving Bitcoin's adoption forward. You know, all this chatter around like, you know, scaling and layers built on Bitcoin, that's all good and kind of pro-innovation, so that's all fine. But I still think that as long as people are gonna like hold money on the base layer, there needs to be like more simpler and intuitive and delightful experience that doesn't really sort of, you know, make people anxious about what happens to their long-term funds and things like that. So how do we make this more mass market? How do we take this to people who will end up like owning Bitcoin on chain, but are kind of like at this point of time stuck between either like, you know, exchanges, the popular exchanges, or at best they are doing like a single sig self-custody using hardware wallet. So I think hardware wallets are a great stepping stone, but I think that's not where one should stop. They should like take more more resilient approach to self-custody, and that's how sort of they are thinking about. And one of the other sort of, you know, pieces was 2022 is as I'm talking about this, right? So one of my very close friends who was much earlier into Bitcoin, so he got into Bitcoin in 2016 in grad school, and he had been stacking since 2016. And unfortunately, during the 2021-22 bull market, he custodied most of his Bitcoin at Celsius, and obviously Celsius collapsed. His you know, average price point was something like $4,000, and once Celsius collapsed, he's kind of like talking to me about, hey man, like, you know, I spent all these years to like understand Bitcoin early, and I spent all these years to like, you know, save my excess savings into like Bitcoin, and then it's all sort of gone poof. So that led me to like very, very strong, it was a very strong signal that even people who are relatively smart in the tech industry, they're still not really like, they're still not really aware about or exposed to the right products in terms of like doing long-term custody of their Bitcoin and their funds. So that was like the final nail in the coffin, and that's how, you know, we got about building Theia.
You know, and that's an interesting story, because people, you know, people will look at kind of the, even people who bought in 2015, 2016, you'd think someone who did all their homework around that time to have the conviction to buy kind of pre-mania during the kind of 2017 run-up, you'd think that they would then custody Bitcoin in the way that it was meant to be held, right? It's the only completely digital bearer asset, but you're trusting it with somebody else. So I can see how hearing that, you go, okay, even the most educated among us, they need like an on-ramp that is as simple as downloading an app on your iPhone and getting your Bitcoin off your exchanges right then and there. Like, even for those people, like, what I'll ask you kind of, I am interested in, you know, why the name and logo for Theia was chosen, because, you know, even though I've been here for a while now, I still don't know. It's a very good looking logo and a very cool name, but I still don't know. And then I'm also kind of curious as to, given that even these like pseudo experts who owned Bitcoin, had a low cost basis, got in early, given they also struggle with self-custody, who does the Theia app serve, right? Does it just serve those people who might not be literate, or does it serve literally everybody? Everybody who's looking to self-custody can do Theia. So I guess kind of like a two-part question there.
Yeah. No, absolutely. So I'll take the second part first, in the sense that I think this observation that everyone who might have like bought Bitcoin in 2015, 2016 must be doing self-custody is certainly wrong. I think at least our market research says that that's not really true. I know a bunch of people in the broader sort of tech ecosystem, Silicon Valley ecosystem, and not just Silicon Valley geographically speaking, I mean like tech ecosystem globally speaking, who were kind of like early to Bitcoin for a variety of different reasons. And they might not have like a super large stack. They might own something like a 0.3 Bitcoin or maybe like a 1 Bitcoin or something like that. But even those folks, which is like a relatively lot of money in today's time, back in the day, they were most likely like, you know, stacking it on like Coinbase and other related exchanges. So if they are not really sort of thinking about Bitcoin day in, day out, if they're not exposed to like the right Bitcoin educators that, you know, you and I know of, it's quite unlikely that they'll actually come to a situation where they want to like self-custody their assets. Just because, you know, all of these folks who are buying Bitcoin in 2015, 2016 have likely been born in the core like fiat age, and they don't really understand why holding, you know, bearer asset in your own self-custodial fashion is an important thing. Nobody really owns like cash or gold in their homes these days. So it's not really a natural thing. You know, it might feel natural to someone like you and I, but it's certainly not a natural thing, even for people who are relatively early to Bitcoin. So yeah, that was the realization that we certainly wanted to sort of, you know, serve this growing need of people who both like were early but did not understand why self-custody is important, as well as a new generation of Bitcoiners who will be minted in today's age and in the coming years, to help them, you know, with like a very super simple, very intuitive, and again, like not be compromising on security at all, right? So we are a Bitcoin only company. We sort of, you know, take security very seriously, like security and sort of making sure that there is always an ability to do sovereign recovery in case like something happens to Theia, is the most core foundational sort of, you know, practice, and that goes into all sorts of product building and engineering at Theia, and you kind of know about this, but it's, you know, worth highlighting. So how do we bring like, you know, sophisticated experience, a delightful product experience layered on top of like an ultra secure multisig or an ultra secure self custodial method, was really the challenge that we were sort of, you know, kind of running into, and that was really the genesis of like, you know, Theia's core value proposition. In terms of how did he get about like naming the company? So, you know, interestingly, the word Theia has a Latin, like in a root word, which stands for, you know, vision and sight. And for us, there is nothing more, there is nothing that, you know, describes long-term vision and sight more than Bitcoin. And that was really the goal that, yeah, like, you know, Bitcoin is a long-term asset. It's not really a get-rich-quick scheme. It's a way for you to like, you know, save money for the long term, for yourself, for your family, for your kids, and it's really about like building a generational sort of, you know, savings mechanism. And Theia wants to play a, you know, a fundamental role in that. We help you not only like buy Bitcoin, but also like help you make sure that you custody your Bitcoin in the right way. And if you want to like involve your family, if you want to involve someone else from your sort of broader ecosystem, there are different ways and mechanisms around Theia and Theia user experience to like make that happen. So yeah,
excellent. I love that, and I love that. You know, the idea of sight, the idea of planning, and you know, thinking about these things well in advance. That's what Bitcoin is. Everything else is a casino, right? Everything else adjacent to Bitcoin, all the crypto stuff, it's a casino at the end of the day. And with Bitcoin, and I tweeted this out yesterday, kind of the notion that, you know, it's not a get-rich-quick scheme. It is a wealth preservation technology. And it is unbelievably smart to say, okay, we view this thing as a multi-generational asset, an asset that's not only in its infancy in terms of monetization, but an asset that as it monetizes and even once it's, you know, reached its full potential, people are going to hold for decades. And so given that, let's position ourselves right here, right now, as the first mover player who is building the easiest way to do that, whether it's just you or whether you're planning for the future, whether it's a multi-sig vault held by you or whether you're doing collaborative custody with members of your family, you know, whether you're doing inheritance planning or whatever it is, understanding that Bitcoin is a long-term multi-generational asset and then building an app now that puts yourself right then and there so people can use Bitcoin the way it's assets, the way that its properties as an asset allow it to be used. I think that's wonderful.
Yeah. No, I mean, like, again, just sort of, you know, doubling down. And I, by the way, I love that tweet. In fact, you sort of spoke about like making sure that you're always like cash flow positive and you think of Bitcoin more as a savings vehicle than like a get rich, you know, quick scheme. And as you rightly pointed out, like most of this get rich quick schemes are actually called schemes and not really like, you know, savings assets. So Bitcoin is fundamentally very, very different. And I think like this sort of long-term vision, long-term sight is a very core, you know, property of Bitcoin. In fact, like we talk about it in the Bitcoin industry as low time preference. And what Theia is essentially a synonym to like low time preference.
Absolutely. Low time preference. And so the other question I have is like, there are other multi-sig providers, major multi-sig providers in the Bitcoin space. What gap in the market does Theia fill? And you've kind of already answered this by describing what it is. But relative to your competitors, what gap did you identify? And then kind of what role are you filling?
Yeah, I would say like the first generation of like multi-sig companies have been phenomenal and in a way also an inspiration to us. I think the fundamental difference between us and some of our competitors is the fact that while you know all of us you know emphasize on security, we are probably the only ones who actually take the experience, UI design, making sure that the person who is holding the keys, the person who are you know adjacent to person holding the keys, are all sort of you know in this together, and making sure that the experience itself is you know not as anxiety inducing. And making sure that there is a nicer like on ramp onto self custody, right? So, it requires a lot of research. It requires a lot of like you know hand holding. It requires a lot of like conviction to actually like go about doing self custody or especially like multisig. And it's a really broken experience from our perspective. And this I'm seeing someone who's been in the tech industry for 10 years. I'm talking about people around me. Who still like find extremely difficult to like handle a hardware wallet just because you know it's not really like I fundamentally think that Bitcoin industry has done tremendously well in terms of ensuring the security of the different products that they have built over the years. The Bitcoin only industry I'm talking about, but it's always come as a trade off to like design and user experience, which we believe is should not be the case. So we bring in the most of tech first, Silicon Valley centric like ethos of making sure that the product is not only secure, but it's also like super easy, super intuitive, and to the extreme, actually a delightful experience to use. And we will not stop till we are, you know, we hit that destination. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Great explanation. And I can say in my own use, it is a delightful experience, right? It's not just one that's like simple and intuitive, but you feel good when you use the app and you want to use it again. So I think you guys are doing a great job and I can't wait to see how the app continues to evolve. Let's shift gears here into Bitcoin accelerationism. This is a concept that for me was first introduced by you and seeing what you were tweeting out about you know, Bitcoin kind of enabling a second renaissance, this idea of Bitcoin accelerationism. which is an offshoot of effective accelerationism. Obviously, for a while, there was effective altruism, the Sam Bankman-Fried type thing of, you know, I'm going to make as much money as I can and then give it all away. Yeah. It seems effective accelerationism is a lot more geared to providing value maximally rather than I'm going to be this big money vacuum and then just distribute it. It seems like effective accelerationism is more poised toward bringing up the individual prosperity of a civilization as individuals, so we can all flourish individually, rather than, you know, one guy earning a bunch of money, giving it all away. Very charitable, but not very sustainable. I guess that's the way I've always looked at it. But what specifically kind of is effective accelerationism? And then what is Bitcoin accelerationism?
Yeah, no, great topic. So I think multiple things to say. I think so you're right in saying that EAC, or effective accelerationism, at some level is essentially a counter, a revolutionary counter to EA, or the effective altruism movement. And we know the biggest cheerleader of EA was the person who is now sitting in jail. EA was always a very top-down movement. You had to be rich to actually be invited to EA parties. EAC is completely different. It's a grounds-up movement. It's made of people who want to like build, and people who want to sort of, you know, create value, and people who want to sort of grow the civilization, grow the pie, and essentially make every one of us like prosperous, right? So at some level, you know, think of this sort of concept of like a human techno-capital mimetic machine. And EAC is a cultural movement that kind of like powers that, right? So there are humans, which is the human civilization, there is technology, there is capital, and then there is memes, which is basically a modern way of like thinking about information and information dissemination. And so EAC has always been like a very grounds up movement. And I think there are sort of key fundamental reasons, or like the key principles that go behind EAC that are always found like super, you know, attractive and very, very, you know, inviting. Has been like this focus on maximizing energy, which basically in the near term means like, you know, investing in like nuclear fusion and things like that. You know, it's all about, you know, things related to like space exploration, making like human civilization interplanetary, even though if it is like decades away, that's fine. But at least the movement moves towards like, you know, wanting to like build a human civilization that is not just sort of grounded in Earth, but there is a possibility of like, you know, moving beyond and like becoming interplanetary. And all of that, what it does is that it, you know, incentivizes humans to kind of invest in like newer technologies and like material science and propulsion technology and things like that. Obviously, EAC also came about during the time when, you know, AI and AGI was really the kind of like the hot thing. So there is a real belief that, you know, AGI and automation and robotics will really sort of bring a lot of value to humans, and it will allow for like full flourishing of the human civilization. So yeah, it's about like embracing like, you know, novelty. It's about embracing like entropic change. It's about like sort of growth, prosperity, and it's for everyone. At some level, you know, the other reason why I found EAC very, very interesting was it's kind of like a decentralized cultural movement. So obviously it's not like decentralized technically like a Bitcoin network, but in many ways it's a cultural network which is like kind of decentralized, which means that there is no one single person or an entity or a company that is running this show. Obviously there are people who are like kind of the thermodynamic priests of EAC, and they kind of like help disseminate these ideas and cultural movements and memes and stuff like that. But, you know, what I thought was one of the only kind of like the missing piece I found in the EAC movement was its grounding in like economics and monetary mechanism, right? So EAC talks about everything perfectly well, but I think one of the fundamental reasons why EAC in itself may not be able to succeed is that it doesn't necessarily understand that central banks and money issued by central banks is, if you kind of end up relying on dollars or any kind of like central bank issued money, we are not really going to accelerate ever, just because the moment you try to accelerate and, you know, generate like capital surplus, central banks will find a way to like dilute that, you know, access savings, access techno capital surplus by printing more dollars. So the EAC movement or the general sort of growth movement needs to like think about money that is outside the control of central banks and like sovereign nation states. And that's where like Bitcoin comes into play. So I believe that the Bitcoin accelerationism fork of EAC is everything that is EAC, but also like making sure that the EAC movement is grounded in an immutable economic and monetary system that ensures that there is no techno-capital dilution going into the future. So that's how I think of like the BEAC fork of EAC. And yeah, I've been tweeting about this stuff, and that's where, you know, yeah. So EAC will never achieve its stated objectives while using money issued by central banks. Inflation of money supply dilutes any and all techno-capital surplus from accelerated productivity. EAC needs to operate on uncensorable and immutable monetary standard like Bitcoin, and that's where I kind of sort of was responding to one of the most sort of influential people in the EAC community called Bayes Lord, that is asking about how what does EAC have to do with central banks. So I think, you know, the EAC folks are like phenomenal, extremely bright scientists, technologists, engineers, but I think they've not spent enough time thinking about money and then what role like monetary printing plays in terms of like decelerating the productivity growth. And that's where I think, you know, Bitcoin will make a phenomenal impact. And to the extreme, I believe that there is no fulfillment of EAC objectives without adoption of Bitcoin at the as a base monetary standard. So Bitcoin in many ways is that, you know, Kardashev monetary standard, as I like to talk about it.
Phenomenal. And the thing here that really gets me too, and it makes sense, it clicks. Like, we as humans want to store our value in something that can't get diluted. The huge techno capital surplus, you know, that stands to come as a result of effective accelerationism, using as much available energy as we can to lift, you know, to increase human productivity, to increase human flourishing at an individual level. We want all of those, all of that ca techno capital surplus as a result of the accelerated productivity. You want to store it in something that's absolutely scarce, not absolutely abundant. Because if you're storing it in the absolutely abundant thing, and just more and more of it is getting created, which is happening, the rate of money printing is accelerating. More of that debt, because more debt is being not only issued, but there are fewer buyers at the margin that are organic, so more of it has to be monetized, so more money is being printed, and that's accelerating over the years and over the decades. And so, as that happens, we don't want the acceleration of productivity and the techno-capital surplus from that to be completely negated by the acceleration of money printing. We want it to, you know, be accentuated by kind of being captured in something that's absolutely scarce.
Yeah, and I think like, you know, there's no better person but like Michael Saylor to talk about this from the Bitcoin perspective. I think he has spoken about inflation being a mechanism through which it leaks energy, like economic energy. And I think that's what I sort of kind of like try to bring to the EAC culture is, you know, I'm fortunate to sort of also like sort of hang out with some of these EAC people in real life out here. And yeah, it's slow. I think a lot of them are now starting to like the fact that Bitcoin is truly grounded in thermodynamics, as is EAC, right? There is a very genuine connection between Bitcoin and energy, and Bitcoin and energy, you know, production, Bitcoin and energy abundance, and that is very fundamental to the EAC movement as well. So I find Bitcoin and EAC to be like truly congruent. And both of them are like extremely deflationary sort of for techno-capital forces. And they also like realize that the state and the state regulations are the real sort of decelerating like phenomenon, and we need to find a system that is outside of the existing system to make sure that there is no deceleration, or there is no leakage of energy, or there is no leakage of the surplus that the techno-capital innovation and acceleration generates. So yeah, some of these ideas might seem like a real out there, and it might feel like a word salad, but I think there is some real sort of, you know, philosophical you know, discussions to be had here. And I think like EAC has been like a very phenomenal movement, at least at the ground level in Silicon Valley, and it's been like very, you know, influential for young people. I think a lot of like some of the older generation Silicon Valley folks have already made their money, or who are like too entrenched in the existing sort of, you know, fiat ecosystem. They were like kind of, and folks who are like philanthropists in nature, they're always like excited about EA and stuff. or effective altruism, but EAC has been a significant sort of a revolutionary counter-argument to EA, and I think that's really a great development, not just for like the Silicon Valley ecosystem, but for the overall nation, like United States, and generally for the human civilization.
Absolutely. In one of your tweets, I mean, an effective accelerationism in general, trying to move humanity to a Kardashev type one civilization, you put in this tweet right here, which I'll actually share on screen, says, immutability of Bitcoin acts as the foundational monetary standard for Kardashev scaling with open source AI and nuclear powered acceleration. What exactly is a Kardashev type one civilization?
Yeah, so Kardashev was the sort of famous, Soviet Russian, philosopher, physicist, sort of futurist thinker, and he came up with this idea of like grading civilization on how much energy the civilization is using. So, I mean, if you look at like human history, like going back 10,000 years or so, like the only real metric on which you can actually like sort of measure growth over like large swaths of time is essentially like how much energy consumption happens on a per capita basis. And that's true not just at a human civilization level, that's true for like nation states as well. So obviously, richer and more developed countries consume more energy per capita, and countries who are sort of, upcoming on that ladder want to like consume more energy. So I think this whole, the whole sort of, green politics and the climate change movement has a really been a deflationary, oh, sorry, a decelerating force towards progress. And EAC at many levels is also counter to that. Again, going back on the Kardashev sort of scaling, what Kardashev type one civilization means is that any civilization who is able to like harness all energy on its planet would be called a Kardashev type one civilization. So we are nowhere close to that. The human civilization is at best a 0.1 Kardashev or type, Kardashev type 0.1 civilization. So we are at least like, orders and orders of magnitude away from being able to harness all energy available on Earth. Think of all the geothermal energy on Earth. Think of all the, nuclear fissile material that we know exists on Earth, and all sorts of like, hydrocarbons that are still sort of, unexplored and unused. So we're still far away from, the Kardashev type one civilization, which is being able to like harness everything and all kinds of energy sources available on planet Earth. And EAC is essentially a movement that, inspires people and influences people to like climb up that Kardashev gradient. And that's the Kardashev, scaling does not stop at type one; it goes to type two, type three, and so on and so forth. It's difficult to sort of imagine if in our lifetime we'll be like hitting past type one. Even type one seems like quite ambitious, but I think again, movements like EAC, movements like Bitcoin, and any other sort of, technologically progressive movements wants to sort of, talk about like consuming more energy per capita and not really like going back to the Stone Age and trying to like reduce energy consumption per capita.
Of course, and I think that with things like nuclear, which you also mentioned in this tweet, and open source AI, I mean, those are two things that will make it so that humans can consume, dare I say, exponentially more energy as individuals,
Yeah,
right?
I mean, you already see that happening today, right? I mean, Amazon just recently bought a data center facility that was next to a nuclear power plant. There is chatter about like OpenAI and Microsoft investing in some like, nuclear capacity and things like that. So you'll see this next generation of technology companies, especially these data center operation companies, who'll be like, who'll be stuck in a loop if they're, relying on the state to like actually generate and power energy for them. So we're gonna like see this separation where this foundational companies and this sort of people who really want to like ensure that the UN civilization progresses, they rely on, harnessing their own energy. And we kind of already see that happening in the Bitcoin mining industry. And that's why so for me, like the parallels between the Bitcoin industry and sort of the broader EAC philosophy is like just truly remarkable. It's just that there are many people are thinking about it right now. But Bitcoin mining and Bitcoin in general is not, I mean, we don't have to talk about this anymore, but like it is all about like an energy harnessing, free energy, harnessing cheap energy out there in the world, and using that to secure the most foundational sort of monetary network out there in the world.
Absolutely. I mean, the incentives with Bitcoin mining kind of align perfectly toward the exact same goals of effective accelerationism, of maximizing efficiency per unit of energy expended, in order for miners to be more profitable. In the same way that we are trying to effective accelerationism is sort of trying to do the exact same thing: leverage the resources we have here on Earth in the most efficient way to bring up human flourishing, the most we can at an individual level. The parallels are kind of uncanny. So to me, it's almost astonishing that more people haven't come around to this. More of the effective accelerationism folks haven't come around to this idea. And one of the other things you said actually was that you think this will happen. You think that large swaths of the EAT crowd will Bitcoinize over the next 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, again, 2 years is obviously sort of an ambitious target that I have for myself in terms of how I want to influence people in this community. But I think it's happening. I think as more and more people realize that relying on central bank issued money is the real decelerating force. Anyone who wants to accelerate will have to adopt outside money, and there is no better outside technological money than Bitcoin. And yeah, I mean, without really doxing anyone specifically, there are like people in the broader community who are like very, very sympathetic to this idea of like Bitcoin being the true money, which allows them to like ensure that there is no censoring, there is no like cancellation happening, especially for the open source AI developers, people who are the California is a weird state where like they're already like proposing legislation that will ban mathematical calculations beyond a certain size, which is effectively what like these AI chips are doing, and it's just incredible like how crazy that is, and
That sounds like
they want
that infringes on the First Amendment almost.
exactly. I mean, you can rely on California to like infringe your First Amendment at several levels, so it's not super surprising at some levels, but yeah.
Yeah, my goodness. Well, so I guess the last thing that I'll ask you here, because I'm certainly interested in it, especially after this conversation. I knew about effective accelerationism, I knew about Bitcoin accelerationism from what you've talked about, but now, I mean, I'm fired up. I'm stoked. I mean, I'm playing an infinitesimal role in accelerating Bitcoin adoption. What do you think the killer app of the 21st century will be in order to accelerate Bitcoin adoption?
Yeah, I think I will go back to the theme of energy, and I'll flip the question around. I will say that technologies and communities and companies and people who are trying to harness free energy, who are trying to accelerate energy consumption, anyone who is trying to generate an abundance of energy, is directly like linked to like Bitcoin in so many ways, most foundationally at the Bitcoin mining layer. But as I said, like the real key input to human growth across like tens of thousands of years across like space and time, is how much energy we consume per capita. So for me, the real sort of killer application would be like figuring out ways of like harnessing more and more energy, and that kind of like directly links to Bitcoin in so many ways. As humans consume more energy, we'll become more productive, we'll become more prosperous, which means that Bitcoin sort of goes up in value per unit of like goods and services that we're able to produce using that additional energy and energy abundance. So this linking at the hip between like energy production and Bitcoin is the real key driver towards everything that Bitcoin stands for.
Excellent. And I think that's a perfect spot to wrap up. The link between energy production and Bitcoin is very fundamental. Figuring out new ways to harness the energy we have here on Earth in a more productive way, to lift everybody up, to increase productivity beyond what we can even fathom right now. Smeet, this has been an excellent discussion. I really enjoyed learning more about you, the origins of Theia, as well as the whole Bitcoin accelerationism movement. for those who might not know where to find you, where would you like to send people to learn more about you, more about your work?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of like active on X at Smeet_Pat. And then if you want to learn about my company, Theia, you know, go down to theia.us. That's theia.us. Try out the app. Try out the best-in-class multi-sig self-custody experience. And we are launching a bunch of different new features, especially before this Nashville conference. So stay tuned for that.
Absolutely, 100%. And we do have a ticket giveaway going on for the Nashville conference. I don't think that's over right yet, Smeet. The winner hasn't been decided yet?
No, we're still looking for the winner.
Excellent, wonderful. So there's still time to register for that. I'll actually go ahead and post another tweet about that so we can find a winner for that. But yeah, go to theia.us, check out the app, follow Smeet on X at Smeet_bot, same way that it's spelled in the title. And, you know, he's tagged in the X post as well. Smeet, it's been excellent. Thanks so much for coming on, man.
Thanks, Joe.